is Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. My guest today is Dr. John Seuss. He's speaking to us on Skype from Vancouver in British Columbia, Canada. So welcome, John, to Tidings.
Yes, thank you very much, Hazel.
On your website, globalpilgrim.ca, you describe yourself as a clinical and peace psychologist, a spiritual traveler, and a social justice advocate. Perhaps you could just introduce yourself to our listeners by saying a little bit about, you know, where you were born and raised so we get some idea where you come from, and then how you became these things.
Okay, well, I was born in Toronto. My family background, they came from Hungary. So that already kind of colored my entry into politics and the psychological struggle for self-determination within a new immigrant population. At a very early age, I guess, started to be interested in what I would call pilgrimage or spiritual travel, traveling to holy places, to sacred landscapes. And my initial trip to Palestine or to the Holy Land really came out of that context, I would have to say. I had for a long time discussed with my father that we would go to this biblical, slightly oriental view that he had. It was idealized, as most Westerners have, of going to the Holy Land. But he actually, unfortunately, passed away before that was possible. And that added a certain sense of poignancy in my mind to go there on my own. And somehow stars aligned, I suppose. And it was Easter. It was my birthday. And I thought, okay, this is the time to pack my bags and head off to the sacred landscape of Palestine / Israel. And then to do that, I thought walking would be a suitable way to do this. So I ended up walking from Nazareth to Bethlehem, about 160 kilometers. But it didn't take very long, maybe a day, if that, is that my vision of the sacred landscape was abruptly altered. And I just play with this idea by juxtaposing few of the letters around. In other words, sacred became scarred, S-C-A-R-R-E-D, and also scared. And then from that, I realized that the sacred has somehow devolved into scarred because you have this ugly concrete monstrosity of a wall that cuts deep into occupied Palestine, stealing farmland, stealing land, colonizing land, separating people from their villages, from their schools, from their clinics, from their families. So the landscape is scarred. Olive trees, the symbol of hope and joy, are being purposefully destroyed as a way of psychologically damaging the people, not to mention their livelihood. And scared, and this is where the psychologist in me got stirred up, that the people there are deeply traumatized. And so they're scared. They're traumatized because of what's been going on for decades and decades in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and Gaza. Although the nature of the assault on the people's psyche and their landscape may differ, but the overarching theme is one of dispossession, land theft, and the ongoing brutal military occupation that became so clear to me. I mean, within the first day of walking, suddenly we didn't walk into a village and the person I was with said, gee, why don't we hop into a car and drive to the next town? And I thought, well, this is absurd. I mean, we're walking here as ancient pilgrims. Why should we be driving in a vehicle? Well, as it turned out, two kids were killed at that site and he wanted me to not be aware of the reality of the occupation in a sense. So to put up the blinds and protect us from the searing reality of it.
He was an Israeli then?
No, he was a Palestinian. Oh. There was like two or three of us walking, and we're staying with Palestinian families for 2-week period as we walked this 100 miles or something. And there I really realized that this is something that's hideous. And there's this planned obfuscation, sort of implicit tacit agreement, whether it's the press or whether it's people coming back or whether it's a more sinister, well-funded group that is designed to perpetuate this image of that part of the world, which really doesn't line up with reality. I mean, the whole Nakba, the whole experience of having been displaced, dispossessed by a massive military, and that mm-hmm. continues. That's the other thing, the displacement and the erasure, if you like, of a people's culture, of their identity, the usurpation of it, is ongoing. The whole notion of a settlement is actually a colonial project, isn't it? Where people are displaced from their own land and settlements are built there, which are racially segregated apartheid structures. And they're not even settlements. I mean, to be correct, they're really cities that look like something out of maybe San Diego or Southern California popped into the middle of the desert. And the water is, in an apartheid fashion, siphoned off from the indigenous Palestinian people. It's illegal for a Palestinian to dig a well on his own land. So when you begin to see this, something happens where the innate quest for justice gets stirred up, and I think people are moved to want to redress this in some form or other. And I guess that's how it started for me. And when I saw that, I thought, well, wait a minute, people ought to know that there's another narrative here, another voice that needs to be spoken from the rooftops loud and clear.
What year was that you did this initial pilgrimage?
That was in 2010.
But you hadn't been to Gaza yet.
No, but from 2010 to now, 2016, I just came back from my sixth trip. I came back from my initial kind of pilgrimage, as it were, the eye openings, sacred to scarred and scared. And then I went back a couple times to somehow clarify how might a psychologist work or assist to the besieged people of Palestine. And then it turned into a celebratory one, which was to join the Olive Harvest. And that was really a direct social action project, because the mere presence of Westerners was a demotivator for armed settlers to harass and disturb the harvest. So we were there with our cell phones and filming and stuff, and that was a demotivator to be filmed while they're disrupting the harvest. And of course, just to participate in an ancient and very pleasant and soothing activity. It's family-based, it's a celebratory feeling. People are joyous about the picking of the olives, and there's feasting. A nice way to deepen my involvement in the Palestinian culture. And at the same time, I tried to bring in some kind of link with mental health professionals there. At one point, I did a seminar there on cognitive behavior therapy for depression. But that seemed very colonial and a little bit off-putting to me. My own behavior was not very satisfying, because I thought, well, here's this Western psychologist who parachutes in and he's going to show people what to do. And I felt a little bit uneasy about that style, because I mean, the people there are already very well educated, and they're very well versed in Western psychological treatments and medical treatments.
And there's also the danger in that kind of situation of not being just colonial, but being kind of voyeuristic in a way, that you're getting more out of it than they're getting.
A little bit. I was also interested prior to this to natural occurring disasters. So when we had the tsunami, maybe 2004, that was another strand in my socialization into working with trauma. Another element that was really educative for me was the difference when cataclysmic events are a result of a tsunami or an earthquake or a volcano versus when they're purposefully engineered by people, as is the occupation. I mean, there's something far more hideous and ugly about when buildings are collapsing, not because of a tidal wave, but because someone is purposefully targeting civilians in a besieged, for example, land strip like Gaza. It just adds to the horror of it. I mean, a natural disaster versus a man-made one is really on a different scale altogether.
How I came to know about you was a post you had written in MondoWise, the wonderful MondoWise website.
Yeah.
And you had written that the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder was simply not applicable to Gaza for two reasons. One, it wasn't post. The trauma was ongoing, is ongoing. And secondly, it's not a disorder. It's a perfectly appropriate response to the stress that is being experienced every day.
Right. That summarizes very well. It's very, very important a change, I think, to add to our nomenclature, because when we talk about exactly how you indicate the PTSD part of the post-traumatic stress, there really is nothing post about a continuous traumatic event. So a 9-year-old child in Gaza will have experienced three major traumatic events, namely Israeli military assault of 2009, 2012, and now 2014-15. So the amount of trauma is inestimable. And furthermore, cues of the traumatic event that then trigger a subsequent re-experiencing of the trauma. Well, the cues for this are everywhere. I mean, a plane flies over and it's immediately associated with the drone. A thunderclap goes on and people run as though there is another bombardment about to be initiated. When will the next bombing take place? Mm-hmm. And the psychiatrist who I spoke to, who lost 26 members of his own family, brings to the fore the kind of work that we were trying to do to recognize that the mental health professionals who are trying to address the psychological trauma of living in this continuous traumatogenic environment of Palestine is compounded by the fact that the psychologists living there experiencing the trauma that everyone else in the population does. But he or she then has this secondary or vicarious trauma of having to hear over and over the horrific stories that their patients are unfolding in their attempt to try to integrate and extract some meaning or to release the tension around it. So there's a dual trauma, the trauma of the experiences that they're subjected to, and then the secondary trauma that they hear from having to work with their clients.
So it's amplified. In a way, you could say that anybody who lives in Gaza has an amplified thing because they hear each other's stories. The mother has her memory or her experience, but she also has that of her child,
right,
who was traumatized. So she's absorbing that as well.
Right. The therapist has to, just like the parent, you know, has to present themselves as powerful, as intact and invulnerable, and that there really is no outlet. And that's one of the problems, you know, because if you're constantly having to show that, you know, you can rely on me because I'm a stable, well-integrated person, that in and of itself creates a burden because that's not how we function. We can't forever maintain this composure of competence in face of this searing and ever-present situation. When we had our seminars and the workshops and the therapists started to unfold their stories, they weren't seen as isolated stories. Everybody immediately resonated and responded to running around during the bombing in this chaotic, disorganizing, horrible atmosphere, the loud noise, the buildings collapsing around them, finding dismembered children in the streets. I mean, it's really like a Goya or a Bruegel painting. It's hard to really comprehend. We started having a discussion about how one of the symptoms of trauma is having nightmares. And two of the, you know, a psychologist and the graduate student sort of both simultaneously looked at me like, are you out of your mind? Nightmare? We are living an ongoing waking nightmare.
When I think of Gaza, I think of rubble. That's another source of trauma, is the physical landscape, because you see everything destroyed around you. If you can talk a little bit about all the other kinds of displacement that have occurred that is included in the trauma.
The physical destruction is enormous. 11,000 homes were completely destroyed. 6,800 is the UN figure, but additional homes were severely damaged. 18,000 homes were wiped out in 53 days. At the peak of the bombardment, 500,000 people were displaced. You know, when I first went to Gaza, the way I got in, because it's not the easiest place in the world to enter, was because the UN had the world's first Gaza Marathon. And the Gaza Marathon was very creatively based on the notion that the length of a marathon is the length of the Gaza Strip, the 26 miles. Imagine that. So 26 miles long and maybe 8 miles wide, 1.8 million people in this very, very tight place. When they say it's besieged, it's not a metaphor. You feel it. I felt it within minutes.
The only way out was the tunnels.
The tunnels, and these had become demonized as being terror tunnels. But really, the so-called terror tunnels were the lifeblood, where electronic equipment, food, fresh water. Some guy was running a clever business by bringing fried chicken in through the tunnels. When I had to buy a cell phone, that came through the tunnels. When everything is cut off, it creates for more of this trauma. You know, when the 15 hospitals and 16 public health clinics were damaged in the 2014 summer bombings, it breaks your heart as a healthcare provider I gave a lecture at a university that half of it was bombed out. It's difficult for an academic to look at a university as being bombed out.
But everybody's lost somebody. And everybody's lost either some physical part of themselves, horrible, horrible injuries, some part of their sanity or their equilibrium. There's tremendous loss, tremendous loss.
Dr. John Seuss, clinical psychologist, is talking about his work in Gaza and about traveling to sacred places. This is Hazel Khan and Tidings on WPKN Radio.
And the people were so happy just to see us be there. Our little delegation, there's nine of us, just a group from Washington State. It's a national group, Physicians for Social Responsibility. And this was the Washington chapter. The psychological component of people suffering in Palestine seems to get less attention. People are more focused on the more tangible, whether it's mending a broken bone or rebuilding collapsed homes.
That's a cultural thing. Western societies are more likely to take a psychological view, right, of trauma.
Maybe. Yeah. Like you were mentioning, Hazel, we're talking about the number of people killed. 1,800 children were made orphans. And then you think about that, and it doesn't take long, you know, you just kind of picture the proverbial pebble into the drop of sadness and how that ripples out and embraces the cousins and the aunts and the surviving parent. And how does that then translate into domestic violence when the father no longer has a job because the unemployment there is the highest in the world?
It is like a pressure cooker in a way, because most of them don't ever leave. Even the refugee camps in Syria, people leave one way or another.
Right.
Back to the mental health professionals. You were there to train them, things like burnout prevention skills, stress management, and so on. Could you talk about that and the use of personal...
personal kind of coping strategy or a relaxation strategy. Well, we had this idea. I mean, it kind of came to us in the group. We don't even make relaxation tapes anymore because that whole technology is so old school. But in terms of creating a self-hypnotic script and have that be dictated, in this case, by the psychologist onto his or her cell phone was the new idea that I came up with. You know, so we made it a personalized, tailor-made relaxation script using images and thoughts from Palestinian culture so that I wouldn't say imagine going to a peaceful place like the beach when in fact the beach there might be associated with my husband being shot by Israeli Navy.
Because all those four
boys playing soccer who were white. Everyone then would have a portable little place that they could visit in their mind's eye as a way of releasing the horror of the trauma and as a way of calming down, distracting from the ongoing turmoil.
You also say the solution is not treatment, it's political. In other words, end the occupation. That will lift the trauma.
Right. And that's important because our society is so psychologized that it's very easy to use psychobabble to whitewash the horrors of man-made social political situation. That's basically political violence. Mm-hmm. And the people are responding to the occupation. And to call it a disease somehow says that the person is vulnerable, they're weak, they're ill. There's no disease here, more of an injury, if anything, than a disorder. Disorder somehow seems to medicalize and say there's something wrong with you, and we just need to cope with it, to adjust to it. I wanted to shift the narrative to really bring together the very important linkage between the clinical and the political. You can't just pretend that we're going to go in there with our little psychological toolkits and help people relax away the tension. That's nonsense. That, in a way, perpetuates the horror by not addressing the root cause, the depression, the anxiety, the nightmares, the children wetting themselves, the domestic violence. So much of this psychological malaise and distress would be lifted if the occupation were to be lifted. That's the point, and that's why people were so happy to hear that, because they feel so cut off, so isolated, so alone. Why don't people care about us? It so often came up.
But yet they do carry on, don't they? Is there a high suicide rate, or is that not part of the culture?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I'm not certain about it. People sometimes talk about, I wish I were dead because this is not living. I have heard that many times. You know, they derive tremendous resilience. The resilience really comes from a deep abiding sense of faith and the sense of social cohesion in spite of the fragmentation of the families. The idea of family life is elevated to such a high, almost sacred level that it in of itself is a tremendous anti-anxiety, anti-depression social network that is a, you know, a psychological savior. And on the one hand, it was also the cause of so much carnage, because when a home was targeted by the bombs, entire families were just wiped off the face of the earth. But on the other hand, the coming together of the people and the large extended families are buffers against the ongoing stress. And then the belief that this can't really go on forever is also sustaining. But unfortunately, for a long time now, there has been very little in terms of signs of hope. So that's why when Westerners come there and they all say, oh, make sure you tell my story, make sure you tell my story, as a way of feeling a connectedness beyond their enclosed area to the rest of the human population. I mean, it's important to feel that you're not entirely isolated like life there is.
You said somewhere that you were continuing your training work via Skype. Are you doing that?
We're setting it up now. I mean, we're exchanging Skype addresses and stuff. And the idea would be using the internet as a way of breaching the blockade. And what it would be really would be some kind of ongoing supervision is the way that we conceptualize it. Because people really didn't want to end this. I mean, it was just such a nice experience to talk about their own trauma in a safe and accepting place. And to continue that, I think, would be very valuable. So that is something that we haven't quite established yet. We're working on making it work.
Yeah. No, I would be very interested to know more about it as you go along. I'd like to know what your thoughts are. These are thoughts that I've been having a lot in the last year or two.
Sure.
I think of all these generations, the Syrians, Iraqis, and the Yemenis, and all of these incredibly traumatized people, and in particular, the children. I wonder how long it will take for generations to be cleansed of this, because more are being born into the trauma. And I wonder to what extent the trauma is actually transmitted from generation to generation, so that even when the external things may have changed and maybe the occupation's over and Syria returns to whatever calm it once was, how long are these people damaged for? Does it ever go away?
It's a disturbing question, because you're right. I mean, the children are born into, that's part of the whole thing of not being post. It's a continuous ongoing, and it's also multi-generationally ongoing. And some of the people don't even have an image. They've never met, for example, an Israeli who isn't a soldier at a checkpoint. So even their perception is dangerously skewed, because of course there are many politically left of center, humanitarian, anti-occupation Israeli Jews. Do they see these people? Do they have a sense that there is another narrative? Certainly not as large a segment of the population as we would like, but there are people who are non-Zionist Jewish individuals who want to end the occupation, feel that this isn't congruent with their sense of what Judaism is all about or what humanistic thinking is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Hope, that's the thing that we talk about amongst ourselves, that the feeling of hopelessness is deeper and larger now because the situation of the occupation is more and more oppressive now. You have laws on the books now that throwing a stone, mm-hmm. which is really essentially a symbolic representation of resistance.
And a very, very ancient practice.
Right. And it's not a security threat. And to throw a stone at the symbol of your vilified occupation, namely the apartheid wall, and then to have that become the reason you're apprehended out of your home at 3 a.m. and put into a prison as a 12 or 13, 14-year-old boy, that begins to deeply color your relationship and understanding of who is the oppressor. So it's very difficult to untangle that. And unfortunately, two sides are getting more polarized as opposed to becoming more integrated.
We could go on talking forever, but I really did want to know about your global pilgrim thing.
Oh, we didn't even talk about that. Global pilgrim really is my love of sacred travel, participating in the age-old notion that going to landscapes that have been over the centuries been imbued with a certain spiritual presence can deepen one's connection to the luminous, to the sacred dimension. And so I seek it out. It's a way for me to maintain a certain sense of balance and wholeness by traveling to holy places.
And then you say, then you become your brother's keeper through the psycho-spiritual growth.
Because it's then you feel by transcending our separateness that we're not just skin encased separate egos, but you can feel a sense of connectedness to the, you know, larger human family, I suppose. And perhaps undergirding my work in Palestine is that feeling, that the suffering that they feel, we feel by empathizing, and that's what compassion is. And perhaps by traveling to different cultures, it brings that reality closer to home. I didn't ever feel other, really. I felt quite the opposite. I felt a very, very warm embrace, a great sense of shared common humanity, recognizing that suffering is universal, that the desire to be free is universal, the quest for self-determination and justice is an international one. I mean, the warmth of the family being brought into their home, have their food being shared, the warm embraces. I mean, no, I never felt alienated or outcast. It was always a very human, warm presence.
Yeah, they welcomed you.
Very much so, yeah. It was a very, very, very nice, human, pleasant feeling for sure. Yeah.
Do you have plans for something next? Are you traveling somewhere? Are you absorbing what you know now?
You know, Hazel, I'm just really, it's been like 10 days since I've been back, so I'm really trying to integrate much of it. I've been really lying a little bit low. It saddens me about how, as a human race, we are seemingly devolving and spiraling downwards. And it saddens me that instead of this dawning of a new age, the new millennium, there is a disintegration and a disorganization that seems quite painful and quite sad to me. And the stories that people told me there of the bombings, and the one psychologist says, you've sort of started saying it jokingly, well, I've become a vegetarian since the last bombardment. And then he says, well, you know, when you see all the dismembered bodies and how it looks like meat and flesh, and then you really realize, my God, the work that I just did there just really just scrapes the surface. I mean, the depth of the trauma there is so unfathomably deep. Why are our governments supporting this? Our governments are clearly enabling it. You know, they're clearly creating the geopolitical atmosphere that allows this kind of war crime to continue. So that's what's on my mind, and maybe writing a little bit about it, talking to you is very good.
Do you consider that, in fact, you have absorbed some of the trauma? You're bringing that back, aren't you, to Canada? Do you feel that?
Well, you know, it's inevitable. You can't help but absorb it. I mean, when you hear the stories and you see the people and you feel a certain sense of warmth and empathy, and then you hear some of their disorganizing sadness and hopelessness. So, yeah, I feel some of it, and I deal with it by writing about it, talking to my own colleagues about it, and trying to tell the story, as I'm doing, with the hope that our government and your government will begin to pressure our politicians to have Israel and our countries uphold our obligations under international and humanitarian law. That's not okay to do what's being done to other people in our name.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you very much, John.
And thank you very much, Hazel, for giving me the chance to speak some of my stories, to share some of my recent experiences in occupied Palestine, and I hope your listeners will benefit and enjoy it.
These are stories that must be told and must be heard.
You've been listening to clinical psychologist Dr. John Seuss talking via Skype from Vancouver, Canada, about his work in Gaza and about traveling to sacred spaces. Tidings is heard on WPKN on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. Tidings podcasts are archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.